application for Friday, April 6, 2007. I can feel that there is a certain energy to the committee today, and it should be an interesting afternoon. As always, I'd like to call a work session on House Bill 2633. And Mr. Olson, if you will be so kind.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2633 specifies the types of schools at which the Department of Human Services may provide vocational rehabilitation training. That's in the original bill. There's a dash 2 amendment, which you have before you, which is a consensus amendment with the Department of Human Services, which replaces the text and changes it from providing vocational rehabilitation training to referring a person for vocational training only. Adds apprenticeship programs to the list of schools and adds some definitions clarifying between vocational rehabilitation training and vocational training. And again, emphasize this is a consensus amendment the Department of Human Services supports. And so the bill, if amended, would only restrict vocational training who DHS could work with. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Members, this bill did come out of the Subcommittee on Higher Education, and since Representative Hunt is here, I'll have him, if he'd be so kind as to, if he'd like to come up on this one and give a little bit of his background with the bill. And for those of you who are not on on the Subcommittee for Higher Ed, this is your chance to ask any additional questions if you'd like to.
Did you want to move the amendment at this time, or wait?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I apologize for the redundancy of those who have already heard this information before. The core issue here is we want to make sure that these public dollars, these vocational rehab dollars, are going to schools, going to institutions that actually are licensed. Unfortunately, the way the statutes are written right now, that is not required. And so schools, you know, institutions that go through the legitimate process under these categories in the bill of getting licensed are really given no additional benefit over the schools that don't go through licensure at all. And so it's really just trying to, I think, close a loophole and make sure that these public voc rehab dollars are spent effectively. We've got a lot of these career schools in Oregon. The total, just in the time from when I originally introduced the bill 2 years ago, there were about 250 schools. Here today, 2 years later, there are already 300. So we've got a burgeoning industry. Many of them are very legitimate, good apples, and some of them are very troubling, some unlicensed bad apples. And I think this closes one piece of the loophole.
Thank you, Representative. Members, any questions of Representative Hunt? Yes? Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. Just one clarification. Are you interchanging the term accreditation for licensed? Are you, because in the bill it says accreditation. And you said the word license.
In the dash two. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Compton, you are correct.
Thank you.
As usual.
He's looking for your vote here.
Well, I already signed on.
I would entertain a motion.
I'm sorry.
More discussion. We'll still have discussion after the motion if you want or before. It doesn't matter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since I was not for that, could you please define for me vocational rehabilitation? I'm not an educator on the committee, so.
Go ahead, Representative.
I'll take the layperson's, Mr. Chair, Representative Wisdom, I'll take the layperson's definition. You'll notice in the bill there are two specific categories. One is talking about rehabilitation that is really much more, you know, teaching someone to ride the bus, teaching someone to use a telephone, very kind of base level. What we're really talking about here is the higher level, the more career training kind of vocational rehabilitation, and trying to separate those two through the definition in the bill. But Mr. Olson may be able to give a more technical definition to that.
Thank you very much. Wasn't it page 3 of the amendment, which is what we're considering now, the dash 2, there is a definition, page 3, lines 25 through 28, and then vocational training is defined.
Can't follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
to you or to Representative Hunt. I understand what the purpose of the bill, but I think, again, my concern would be the people. So we've got to take away some of the people that are needing this service. Are there enough accredited institutions to provide all the services that people are going to need, I guess? And I apologize if this has all been discussed.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a very good question. I think there is definitely a growing number of career schools. There are also a growing number of career schools that have gone through this accreditation process, that have gone through the whole process to get really where the state has legitimatized them and said, you are good to go and to go serve students. So we've got a growing number of schools that fit that category. We also have, unfortunately, a significant number of schools that have not gone through that process. And so I don't think the issue is not a lack of number of slots or schools. The core issue is just making sure that the slots that they're going into, if they're using public dollars, I mean, it doesn't close off anybody's ability to use private dollars, but if public dollars are being used, just to make sure those are legitimate slots in legitimate schools.
Thank you. One follow-up, and I'll go ahead. Thank you for Representative Hunt, I guess. And so once we get this list of accredited schools, is there any process to monitor those accredited schools to be sure they're delivering the services we're paying for?
Mr. Chair, Representative, actually, the next bill you'll be considering, I think, gets at that very core issue.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this is just the accreditation process is for public or private schools, and it can be done by the state, but there's also accreditations through associations that have some legitimacy, and I know that in certain places those accrediting institutions, if they do one, the state will accept it, and vice versa. Is that the case in these as well?
Mm-hmm. I don't have the actual dash 2 numbers in front of me, but I believe that actually is one of the, if you look at the sections in the actual bill, I believe one of the specific sections that qualifies it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin. And just to follow up on the issue, actually the career schools, according to this bill, are only required to be licensed under statute, so they don't, it sets forth schools accredited by the U.S. Department of Education, schools approved by the Oregon Assistance Association, community colleges, OUS, OHSU, and then career schools licensed under ORS, and it cites it, and then apprenticeship programs registered with the state. So there's a number of categories, different sort of levels of registration or accreditation.
Thanks. One final follow-up. Representative, this basically is that did the people with disabilities and others, have they come forward to say they support this bill? We haven't talked to them. Do you know?
Mr. Chair, Representative Roblin, haven't heard any concerns expressed from any of those folks.
Yeah. Thank you. Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, sir. There is a definition in here that talks about handicapped individuals, disabled individuals. We did pass a bill, I believe, this week that talked about individuals with disabilities rather than disabled individuals.
Right.
Is it safe to assume that that will automatically be cleaned up as the bills get put together at the end if these both pass?
That's an excellent question. I don't have the answer to that, and I would assume that, and we could check that with legislative council.
If not, when it gets over to the Senate, they could pick that up as an amendment.
Making up line 8. I've been informed that I neglected to ask you to identify yourself.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. Dave Hunt from Clackamas County.
Representative Clinton, do you have a comment you wanted to make on this?
I just wanted to comment in the subcommittee. We did hear from the from Stephanie Parrish Taylor, who is the administrator of the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, and she actually was the one who brought the amendment, saying we're a little worried if you don't add this additional amendment that some of the customized on-the-job training and other things that we do contract for and oversee might not be okay, so can you add it, and then we're good. And so she came back and said, great amendment, thank you very much, and we moved the bill.
I think the Representative Clem had teased out the answer I want, but I want to be sure. On occasion, the apprenticeship programs can be used predicated on the number of disabilities and the number of rehab situations. They would not be excluded with this legislation, would they?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Dahlem, actually, apprenticeship programs that are, again, registered with the state under, if you look at the Dash 2 amendments on line 19 and 20 on the first page of the Dash 2 amendments, they specifically would be one of the categories that qualify. Now, any unlicensed, any unregistered, excuse me, apprenticeship programs would not. Again, trying to find a common definition, so we've got whether it's a career school or an apprenticeship program or an institution or a university, they've got to have gone through some public either accreditation, licensure, or registration process.
Well, this is not a follow-up. This is an entirely different area, but when we talk about licensure, and I have some understanding of bone rehab and its proliferation and share your concern. When we say licensure, though, what does that mean? As an example, in another time, in another place, we looked at a place that was going to teach students to weld, and what we found out is they were making stoves, and that was about it. What is entailed with licensure? Is it a simple matter of applying, or do you have to have some proof of legitimacy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, for that, since they're licensed, the career schools anyway are licensed by the Department of Education, that may be better. If there is someone in the room from the Department of Education, that may be a better question for Mr. Allen.
Sure. Thank you.
Is that Mr. Allen looking forward?
Yes, it would.
Mr. Allen, if you would, if he has no idea.
Not his department.
He said that was his question.
He can get that answer and get back to us, though, I bet.
Representative, Mr. Olson has the statute in front of him.
Some of the relevant statutes, there may be more, first of all, definition that a license means the authority the career school has been granted to operate under ORS 345.010. This is the definition. Then it later says in 345.030 is sub 2, is a license to conduct a career school should be granted only after the applicant has presented proof of satisfactory to the superintendent of public instruction or the representative thereof. The applicant complies with applicable standards adopted under ORS 345.325. And ORS goes on and has more about it being non-transferable and needs to be renewed and has more details on the licensure.
That answers my question. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Kopp.
Just a comment for the committee in appreciation of the Dash 2 amendments on line 11 that we already have, that this is going to be approved by Oregon Student Assistance Commission, so we do not have to have a long meeting about that today.
You already wasn't listening, Representative. I'm so sorry.
Exactly. Didn't even hear. Completely.
Ah, well. Thank you. I would entertain a motion at this point if there is one on the amendments.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2633.
Thank you. Representative Kopp has moved the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2633. Is there any further discussion?
I was just going to follow up because the Representative Clinton had not heard Representative Kopp's comment on the fact
he's still not listening.
He is now. I'm
listening with both of you.
And also to answer to Representative Dahlem's question, OSAC is specifically listed in the bill as one of those organizations that will do this, so we thought we could get a quicker acceptance of this one.
I think Derek called it the Oregon Student Association a minute ago on accident. I was thinking, well, we could let lobby groups begin accrediting things, but
that might be the wrong thing.
Thank you, Mr. Principal. I mean Representative Rubin.
The motion Representative Kopp has moved Dash 2 amendments, and without seeing further discussion, I'll probably go ahead and ask for a roll call vote.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Dahlem?
Aye.
Representative Greenwood?
Aye.
Representative Kopp?
Aye.
Representative Kremmel?
Aye.
Representative Lynn?
Aye.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Buckley?
Aye. The motion carries.
Mr. Chair?
Vice Chair Kopp.
I move House Bill 2633 to the floor with a due pass as amended.
Vice Chair Kopp has moved House Bill 2633 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk call the rule?
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Dolan?
Aye.
Representative Greenlee?
Aye.
Representative Crump?
Aye.
Representative Crummel?
Aye.
Representative Lynn?
Aye.
Representative Groveland?
Aye.
Representative Lizen?
Aye.
Chair Buckley?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Clem, would you be kind enough to carry this bill for us on the House floor?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2633 and open the work session on House Bill 2845. And fortunately, we still have Mr. Wilson and Representative Hunt to remind us about what this bill is all about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2845 allows the Department of Education to conduct financial audit of career schools. It prohibits career schools from including the arbitration clause in student enrollment agreement, increases the annual fees for career school licensure, requires the superintendent of public instruction to complete investigation of complaints against a career school within 60 days of commencing investigation, and it specifies the maximum civil penalties that may be collected from career schools for certain violations. That is what the bill does, Mr. Chair. There is a amendment which has some key changes, and you have it before you in the packet of materials, members. The S3 replaces the entire text and would make the following key changes. On the audit, the new language would permit the Department of Education to, quote, require career schools to submit an audited financial report signed by an independent certified public accountant and to conduct program audits of career schools as provided by rule of the State Board of Education, unquote. It also clarify that the type of arbitration being prohibited is binding arbitration. It changes the fee schedule to lower the raise for in a charge in the fee schedule for in-state schools with under $125,000 in tuition income, and further raise the amount of the license fee charge in the fee schedule for all other schools. Changes the language so the Department of Education must notify a complainant within 30 days that they have received the complaint and what they are doing with it. And it also reinstates language that mandates consideration of mitigating factors prior to opposing a civil penalty. Because of the adjustment in the fee structure, this does have a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. And there's some additional materials in front of you on this bill, and I also emailed some other ones to the committee members to clarify some of the issues of arbitration. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Person, would you like to comment on background on this bill, or just let us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The real impetus for this bill was really the experience that we've unfortunately had in Oregon, that students have had in Oregon, with some schools like BCTI, which were not effectively serving their students. They were charging very significant costs to students, reaping in lots of student aid, public aid, having their students rack up a lot of loan debt and not leaving them with an end product, and in many cases leaving them holding the bag because they had not completed, the school had not completed the obligation even to provide the training that they should have. Ultimately, they were shut down, but it was after a very extended process. And the whole focus of this bill is to make sure that the Office of Educational Improvement and Innovation, the career school arm of the Department of Education, has some increased ability to make sure that future BCTIs do not occur. Again, we've got a very fast-growing industry among career schools, and many of them are effectively serving their students, and some of them are not. And the challenge is, how do we make sure not only that students' private dollars are effectively going to meet this need, but also, frankly, that the public dollars through loans, the public dollars through grants, are effectively going to serve those needs. There was some significant questioning in the subcommittee related to the whole binding arbitration, non-binding arbitration, dispute resolution issues. You actually have a sheet, I believe, before you. Yours is not colorful like mine, but it talks about why Oregon should prohibit binding arbitration clauses in these for-profit student enrollment agreements. A couple points I would just point out to you in this piece. I won't read it. You've got it before you. But the whole goal here is really to make sure we've got an even playing field. When you have a situation with a for-profit school, a for-profit college, and a student, and a binding arbitration where there is cost involved and attorneys to be paid, you don't have an even playing field. There's nothing in this that would prohibit any kind of alternative dispute resolution processes, non-binding arbitration, mediation, other kinds of processes. It would just prohibit the inclusion of binding arbitration clauses. You'll notice under the third point on there that community colleges and universities do not use binding arbitration clauses. And in fact, the University of Phoenix, probably being, I don't know if they're the largest for-profit career school in Oregon, but they, very reputable for-profit institution, they specifically refuse to include binding arbitration clauses in their agreements because they even have acknowledged that it's unfair to students. The fifth and sixth point on that sheet notes that the huge default rate, the huge student loan default rate, student aid default rate of among for-profit colleges, over 44% default rate. And I think the challenge really here is having a binding arbitration clause has real potential to prevent the students from being able to go to court. And when you have a situation with a binding arbitration clause, the school has the ability through the binding arbitration clause to go after them and get them, force them into an agreement. If it's the student that is trying to make their case, they don't have the right to go back against the institution. Say it's a situation with where a student has an allegation against the school, they do not have the same ability. We've got a situation here where these for-profit schools are getting over 90% of their revenue from public funds. I think we've got a real obligation to make sure that they are being regulated effectively. Mr. Olson noted that this is going to Ways and Means. I think we are still working with the career schools to make sure that we've got the fee schedule right. So I think in Ways and Means there'll be an opportunity to look at the fee schedule again and make sure we've got it right. The whole goal is to make sure it's revenue neutral. So we've got some increased fees, which the schools have acknowledged are it's legitimate to have some increased fees in order to create a position within the Department of Education, specifically to make sure that these schools are effectively serving students and are not are being good apples and not bad apples.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Wisnik. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hunt realized that I was not in the subcommittee that looked at this bill. Concerning the audits by the Department of Education, is that going to be very expensive, and how many FTEs, and do they look at putting that under the Secretary of State's responsibility and contract, you know, out or what? And also then my other question before Representative Dallum weighs in. Mrs. Boss's report to us, I thought the arbitrators do not necessarily have to come from the state of Oregon. Could you comment on those, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, you raise an excellent question on the first point, and that's exactly why in the Dash 3 amendments before you, we really tried to separate out the whole issue of financial audit versus program audit. So the financial audit would not be done by the department under the Dash 3. They wouldn't be done by the department or the Secretary of State. They would be done privately by independent CPAs. They would then just have to be submitted back to the department. The program audits, however, would be done by the Department of Education, and that I think we think is a legitimate focus for them. If you look at the Dash 3 amendments to 2845 on line 8 and 9, it talks about enabling them to conduct program audits of career schools.
They're just going to submit the audit. That makes Mr. Chair. That makes sense.
Thank you, Representative.
Representative Crowell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, you made a comment that a student can't force arbitration on a school. If there is an arbitration agreement between the school and the student, why can't a student force arbitration?
There's actually, as I understand, Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, as I understand it, for instance, students who default on a loan, for instance, they, even under a case where there's a binding arbitration clause between the school and the student, they specifically, the school would have the ability to go after them to get that money, but the binding arbitration clause would actually prevent the student from going to court to address complaints of things like false advertising, inadequate training, poor job placement. they would be able to raise it in the course of the binding arbitration, but they would not have the access. And again, you've got a very unlevel playing field because it might be a school represented by a very experienced legal counsel, a student not represented. You've got an unequal playing field. At the place where it might be a more equal playing field, they would not have the ability to go there under binding arbitration. They would be specifically excluded from going to court to address any complaints, whether it's related to false accusations, false claims that the school had made of we will provide X, we will guarantee you these kind of outcomes as a result of your education, or whether it was related to poor job placement assistance.
Mr. Chair, I find that those comments fascinating. And the reason why I do is that unless you're looking at an agreement from a school, if a school says that any dispute, if a contract says any disputes would go to binding arbitration, that would be the same on both sides. So if the student had a complaint, I'm not understanding why they wouldn't be able to take it to an arbitrator instead of taking it to court. And if there's an arbitration clause, Mr. Chair, in the contract, the court is going to turn around and tell the complaining party to take it to the arbitrator first before bringing it into court.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, I may have misspoken. The student would not have the right. They would have the right to raise it under the binding arbitration clause. They would not have the right to raise it in a court where they have a much fairer chance of having an equal playing field. They would be forced to raise it only in the binding arbitration clause, and in that case, there's no additional avenue of dispute resolution for them.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative?
So,
I didn't say I wouldn't have.
Are you making the assumption then that a student would not be represented going into an arbitration hearing, but they would be represented going into court? And why wouldn't they be represented going in? If you're going to hire a lawyer to go to court, why wouldn't they hire a lawyer to go to arbitration?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, it may well be a challenging situation even for them in court, but since a binding arbitration clause, you do not necessarily have someone who's looking out. I mean, the arbiter is not necessarily looking out for what is going to be the fair decision. The arbiter is looking at what is the who most strongly makes the case. The real core issue is what's going to put the student in the best position of being able to resolve the issue to their satisfaction, and to a fair conclusion. And that's why, I mean, I think the fact that community colleges, universities, even private schools like the University of Phoenix, specifically do not use binding arbitration because they've acknowledged that it does not create an even playing field between school and student. That's the route we're attempting to follow here, just to apply that as well to these schools, which is also an approach that other states have taken.
Follow up?
One follow-up?
Have you seen this memo from Ann Boss?
I have not.
Dated April 5th?
No, I'm not.
It says in here, and these are thoughts on arbitration. Thoughts from Ann Boss. It says arbitration is binding unless an agreement explicitly states that the arbitration is advisory only. If the two parties don't agree upon advisory arbitration, all arbitration results are binding. Whenever the agreement states arbitration by itself, the awards and the decisions are set. Binding arbitration means that the results cannot be appealed unless the arbitrator grossly exceeds his or her authority or the award violates significant explicit public policy. What that means is that the court will not revisit the facts of the case or revisit the rightness or wrongness of the award. It is very unlikely that a binding arbitration decision will be reversed or changed by a court. My point here is in the first part of her comments. So unless this specifically says that a school, because the way this reads is a career school may not be issued a license if the career school includes a binding arbitration clause in their student enrollment agreement of the career school. But if they have any arbitration clause in their
in their, according to Mrs. Boss's letter, if they have any arbitration clause, it's binding. So, if I don't think your amendment is getting you where you want to go. If that's the case, wouldn't you need to have it exclude all arbitration?
Members, Jim Boss is available if you do want clarification on this. Mr. Olson has spoken to her specifically on this point. Mr. Olson, if you'd like to elaborate.
Thank you. And just, Ms. Sharon, and I'm not an attorney, but talking to Ms. Boss, we discussed the text in the amendment, and after some consideration, it was my understanding from her comments that it was explicit enough that it was specifically prohibiting binding arbitration, that that there would not be a problem for other types of arbitration because the statute specifically prohibited the binding. But she's also said she's happy to come and address questions if we need further clarification.
So, Mr. Chair, so what that means then is that it is a de facto advisory arbitration. Is what we're creating here. Is a de facto advisory arbitration.
That is correct.
Mediation. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
If you want to call, I have other members who want to speak as well.
I understand. In section, on page 3, starting on line 27, it's talking about when the superintendent receives a complaint, she or he has to notify the person that the complaint was received and the disposition of the complaint. But there's not anything in there from a standpoint of how long the superintendent has, unless it's an existing statute and I've missed it, how long the superintendent has to dispose of the complaint. So they could say, well, yeah, BCTI, we got your complaint, and the disposition is we decided to do nothing. So it ends up kind of being a so what. So I'm not sure I understand why we're bothering to direct the superintendent to do anything.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, I think one of the challenges that we learned through the whole BCTI process is that there are not clear, well, two lessons. One, that there are not enough staff in this particular office in the Department of Education to actually be able to look into complaints with any kind of depth when they're made. And secondly, that there are not timelines outlined in statute. This is one attempt to actually put at least one timeline in statute, the 30-day requirement, to make sure that when a complaint is made, that there is at least some accountability of the department back to that person. Now, I think to be fair, in order to put on that kind of a timeline, we also have to give them some resources. This is what the other part of the bill does, to actually provide a staff person to, knowing those complaints are coming, to actually have a level of adequacy for those, to follow up on those complaints. And not just, the intent is certainly not just to say we received it, but we don't have staff to investigate it, therefore it's closed. It's to acknowledge receipt and pursuit of the concern.
Ms. Boss, thank you for coming in. Are there questions? Our legislative council did come through. Does anyone have questions for legislative council that they would like to ask?
Well, I guess, Mr. Chair, if I can revisit this, basically, I guess what I would like to ask. Thank you, Mrs. Boss. What I would like to ask is, are we in fact just creating a de facto advisory arbitration if there's going to be arbitration between a school and a student?
Representative Kummel, my name's Ann Boss with Legislative Council, and as I heard your comments earlier, Representative Kummel, I thought they were exactly correct and how I meant to characterize this, that if you use the word arbitration, and it will be final and binding unless you expressly say that it is advisory, but by putting the words binding arbitration clause, in the legislation as something that you're not going to allow the school to do. And I think that's because of the disparity in the power between the school and a student, and that's when the courts look at arbitration clauses with disfavor. Because you're expressly saying you don't want it to be binding, the school would be precluded from putting an arbitration clause of any nature other than an advisory arbitration clause in a contract with a student. Okay. And that's why I thought this language would be fine.
And then may I revisit with her the issue that
go right ahead.
Representative Hunt made the comment that in an arbitration situation that a school could if a student didn't pay, that a school could arbitrate against the student and that the student would have to respond and so on and so forth. But he also said that if the student felt that there was that they had a dispute with the school, they didn't deliver on what they said they would, false advertising, whatever the case may be, that the student couldn't force the school into arbitration. If there's an arbitration contract in an arbitration clause in a contract, doesn't that force both parties into arbitration if there's a complaint by the other party? And if a student can't force a school into arbitration, then why can't they?
Well, I'm suggesting that there couldn't be an arbitration clause in a contract between the school and the student because, yes, if there's an arbitration clause, both the student and the school have agreed that any dispute will be submitted to arbitration and it will be final and binding.
Mr. Chair.
So,
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Hunt said he accidentally misspoke, that he said they couldn't go to court under binding arbitration, and he clarified that point already.
I must have misread that.
Sorry. Right. Is that? Yeah, thank you.
But to clarify, if there is an arbitration contract in a clause in a contract, it's binding. It's not necessarily binding. It could be advisory, but it is incumbent on both parties to honor it.
That's correct.
If we didn't have this in the statute and a school had that in their contract, then they would have to honor it.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'd like to comment, and as I commented in the hearing, my problem with binding arbitration is I don't think it necessarily goes both ways. The question is, what's the nature of the dispute? And I think a school, for example, if a student doesn't pay tuition or doesn't pay a debt that he or she has with the school, they can go to small claims court or other court to collect that debt. That isn't a question of a dispute. And it isn't always easy to create the notion of a dispute and force the school into binding arbitration when the school has other tools at their hand. And I think that's the problem that I have with forcing the signing of a binding arbitration. It seems to me it gives the school a lot more power than the student has. I mean, I think that power is very unequal.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion, Representative Clem?
Just wanted to read something that's in an article I think we all have a copy of, but University of Phoenix, which is a widely respected, legitimate operation, is quoted in this Chronicle of Higher Ed article saying, well, first, the reporter says, top officials at the University of Phoenix agree with that reasoning, that being something else, and say their concerns about the fairness of arbitration clauses keep them from using the clauses in contracts with students. Quote from Laura Palmer, Noon, president of the University of Phoenix, there's the issue of whether students feel they have a meaningful choice in agreeing to arbitrate. They may not even know the clauses in there, and we don't want them to feel that they're trying to limit their rights. So clearly in the industry, not everyone uses them, or the big ones don't for this very reason, and it's just a philosophical issue whether the state should get involved and say, we don't want the other ones to use them too. I feel that is the role of the state in this case, and I know others may not. You know, I don't know how we'll end up, but I think that's the basic issue. I believe that they should be able to go to court over it if a mediation or a non-binding arbitration works. We use binding arbitration for police and other things because it's critical. But, you know, this isn't a reason to use a binding arbitration. This is not you know, they can't go on strike exactly, so you go to court.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Donovan, do you mind responding?
Yes,
Sarah Buckland, members of the committee. One thing that you can keep in mind is that the parties can always agree to voluntarily arbitrate or use some alternative dispute resolution. If you have an arbitration clause in an agreement, then you are bound by it.
Thank you.
Now, I should say that the parties can decide to mutually waive the arbitration clause, but the point is that you have a disparity in bargaining power here, and the courts generally frown on arbitration clauses in consumer loan situations and in other situations where there is a disparity of bargaining power.
Thank you very much.
President Donald.
Yes, I don't have a question for Ann. And when you have somebody of a quality and character, you want to question them. But my question is really for Representative Hunt, and it's twofold. One, the guaranteed student, we talked about public dollars going to these institutions. Does the guaranteed student loan program have a saving process so that they're not sending money to institutions that they know will put their student in a position where they may not be able to repay?
I'm sorry, excuse me, Representative. I do think we have two more questions.
Oh, excuse me, I'll come back.
So, can we come back? Is that all right? Well, thank you very much.
Mine's not for Mrs. Boss.
Mine is.
Representative.
Yeah, mine had to do with binding arbitration, actually. And thank you for being here. And thank you, Representative, for letting me do this. Oftentimes in the binding arbitration clauses, it states in that agreement that you can arbitrate binding arbitration over the fees, for example, collecting of fees. But in that arbitration, you can't bring up other issues, such as the fact I didn't pay the fee was XYZ. Is that true or not? Can you bring up all the issues?
Okay. Representative Vogel, members of the committee, that would entirely depend on how the clause is written.
Okay. Yeah. And that was the part that, from my perspective with the student loan, sometimes it'll say, we have bargaining arbitration over not paying the fees, and you cannot bring in the fact that we didn't go ahead and we didn't fulfill our obligation. Those are not brought into the arbitration. The only thing is whether I paid or didn't pay. And so that's all that gets to come into the arbitration. And at the end of the day, the student says, well, yeah, I didn't pay the fees. He said, well, you lose in the story. And I think that, to me, is why binding arbitration is sometimes very frustrating in any of these cases, because in the initial agreement, they limit the kinds of things that you can bring to binding arbitration. And all of a sudden, you're sitting there wanting to complain about XYZ, and you've already signed an agreement that you won't take it to court, and you can't talk about the thing you want to talk about. So I understand how this kind of agreements give too much power to the one side of the other, so I appreciate the fact.
Thank you, Mr. Robert. Are there any further questions from the boss? Thank you so much for coming in and helping to
clarify.
Representative Dolan, I have a question for Representative.
A long time ago in another land, I sat on the Guaranteed Student Loan Board, and that board, and we did have, not near like your concerns for today and the proliferation of questionable schools, but the student, in order to get a loan, had to be enrolled in a qualified institution. Do you know, is that still true? Is there a saying in that direction so that when the loan is made, there's some notion of what kind of institutions can get the money?
He's going to defer to your colleague, Representative.
Yeah, I'll take a shot at that one. OSAC was a student loan guarantor. We also house the degree authorization program, where we look at different schools offering degrees and whether they're legitimate, sort of the equivalent of the career schools office. And the federal government, to a great extent, delegates down to the states the licensing, and sometimes regionally. I mean, the U.S. Department of Education does have a program where you can be accredited through there, but they really delegate a lot of this down to the states on quality control. Now, the FBI for example, does get involved in fraud and has raided some of these schools and found that student loans are being used there, federal financial aid is being used there. So there's really insufficient federal protocols, I think, around this, and it's been delegated to the states, and that's why we have various state licensing bodies in both arenas. We have regional accreditors, but the federal government has some general language, I think, in their various program rules for both Pell Grant and for student loans that are guaranteed or subsidized. But the enforcement of all that seems to be with the accreditors and with the states.
And if I can follow up on that, Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlem, and I think there is therefore the inherent assumption on the part of the federal government that we are doing that job fully, we in the state. There's also, I think, the assumption on the part of students that we are doing that job effectively. So when they see that a school has the stamp of approval from the state, they're assuming that there is that there's adequate upfront investment on the part of the state in making sure that that's a legitimate school, as well as an ongoing pursuit of that. And based on the staffing levels we have right now in the Department of Education, mm-hmm. that is just not occurring, as the BCTI situation illustrates.
And if I have a question for the representative, did the committee look into the notion, because these institutions are a commercial enterprise and this would be a consumer complaint, of lodging these complaints with the consumer side of dispute resolution rather than the Department of Ed? Did you look at that at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative Allen, I think because we as a state have lodged, at least today, we've lodged that responsibility for the whole regulatory component to make sure the schools are being treated fairly, to make sure the students are being treated fairly within the Department of Education. That the only discussion we ever had all along the way was how to make that work, not where to make it work.
Then the question would be, is we've settled on the Department of Ed. Does the Department of Education have expertise presently complaint resolution and in adjudicating the fitness of a commercial enterprise?
I might be because you guess, Mr. Allen, if you want to come up. Good. Right. Representative Dunham, Mr. Olson does point out that Section 2, Sub 2 of the amendment does require a program audit of career schools. Mm-hmm. So that you're fine with that, but your question is about complaint resolution on
and a program audit also.
For the record, my name is Debbie Kresge, and I work for the House Democratic Caucus Office. And to answer your question, Representative Dunham, in our research on this bill, we did look at whether or not states choose their Departments of Education or their equivalents of DCPS to regulate these schools. And by far and away, I don't want to say all, because we didn't look at all 50 states, but the vast majority choose the Department of Education because these are not typical consumer affairs. These are students who are seeking an education, and so therefore the states have decided that their appropriate place is in the Departments of Education rather than in their consumer affairs departments. And the complaint resolution process also, sorry.
And if I might follow up, for the record, Morgan Allen, Legislative Director, Department of Education. I have in front of me, we have 37 pages of administrative rules that our department abides by, and basically soup to nuts what these schools do, how we license them, accredit them, check and make sure that they're providing good services to students. And I heard a question earlier about staffing. Right now we have about the equivalent of 2.5 FTE that would work with the over 300 schools that we currently have in Oregon. So we have, and that's about 6 or 7 people, I believe, as part of their functions in the department, work on complaints, licensing, and monitoring these schools. So it's, as Representative Hunt said earlier, the growth in these schools is tremendous. Right now we have, I think, between 5 and 10 applications for brand new schools on top of the 305 that we already have operating in Oregon, and that number's jumped in the last 3 years. I think 3 years ago it was about 225 or 230. So this is a tremendous growth industry, and our current staffing levels, which are all paid for by fees, no general fund, basically the schools pay for us to license them and monitor them all through fees, have not grown at all to sort of meet the extended pressures that it puts on us to make sure that the students are getting a good education and the schools are doing what they should be doing.
Thank you very much.
Representative Wisman, do you have questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Chair,
I agree with intent of Representative Hunt's bill here. I don't disagree with that. I think that I have some need to clarify some things for me so I understand it better. And I would suggest to Representative Hunt that the Ways and Means process in the new Section 2 and Dash 3, I think the Department of Education should require career schools to submit annual or biennial audit reports, because they're, I don't think that's unreasonable. You're giving them federal money or state money, they should do that, and then say the Department of Education may conduct the program audits. But I think financially audits should be required normally when you're getting federal money. But based upon my concerns and need to understand it better, I'll be glad to give a yes vote today, but I may reserve the right to change the vote if I found out other. I don't like it if the fees are too high or something like that.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Flynn.
I just want to share a little bit of the testimony that was in the House subcommittee, because we did talk about financial audits and came back to, well, let's let them turn those in. And program audits, what the instructor, really courageous woman who blew the whistle on her employer, filed a complaint with the state that has now led to the closure of BCTI. She said, the program, quote, that we were offering was a joke. We had people who could barely remember their own name from day to day, supposedly being trained to learn about a real solid computer training job program, and it was a joke. And I sat there every day knowing it, and after a few months, I just couldn't take it. I was invited to come speak to their class, actually, at one point, as a computer guy in town. The instructor who invited me about 3 days ago wrote me an email saying, I heard about this bill, and I saw some things you wouldn't believe while I was there, and if you want to talk about it, I'll tell you about it. I mean, this is obviously a bad actor, BCTI, so I don't mean to imply everybody. Actor. Sorry. But the importance for me of the program audit, and this was something we did at the Student Assistance Commission for the schools who offer degrees, is you really look to see, are they actually offering something of meaning in their programs, or is it really just make work in order to get the Pell Grants? And they were gaming the system through recruiters, hanging out at shopping malls and saying, hey, you want to go to school? And they'd figure out if they were eligible for a Pell Grant. Okay, you're coming to school. It didn't matter. It was disgusting. It really was, and that's the part about the program audit is you kind of want to make sure that the business is fiscally sound, of course, so they don't go under, but also that they're teaching something of value so that $10,000 piece of paper means something when they get out of there.
Thank you, Representative. Representative
Dole? Just a final comment. I think we're on to something that has to be done, but I would rather see the program audit, the May audit. We have schools, public schools, that aren't audited. And if there's reason to believe that there's inappropriate behavior, we need a tool to go there. But to create an audit when there's no complaint and on the surface everyone's happy, I think is to create an audit of a program that may not need it.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Dahlman, I completely agree. And actually, if you look at the Dash 3 amendments on line 5, it says the Department of Education may.
Thank you.
And then jump into 2, conduct program audits. Because even with this additional staff, there is no way they will be able to conduct annual program audits of all these schools.
And I know the workload that Ledge Council is under, but if we could possibly have the amendments before we come to the committee meeting, I know everybody's hurrying and everybody's working and everybody's doing their job, but any effort we could do to do that, it gives us an opportunity to read the material, find the word may. I find myself scrambling through.
Again, my apologies. We are trying to get numbers out, and we will need to push to get them to you in advance. These were sent last night via email. So, again, I think, particularly as we're in the last 2 weeks of April, last few weeks of April, I really just want to encourage you to, if you don't already check email on a regular basis, make sure you do check from Mr. Olson, because he is doing his darndest to try to get materials out.
I thought he's a spammer.
Don't delete Mr. Olson's emails. I would entertain a motion on the amendment at this point.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 2845.
Vice Chair Comp has moved the Dash 3 amendment to House Bill 2845. Is there further discussion?
Mr. Chair,
yes, Representative.
I have just to lead questions concerning the fee increase here.
Yes.
And just someone explain why this much fee increase is required. That's what I need to know.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Hunt.
Mr. Chair, Representative Blum, thank you very much for the question. The intent is really to do two things. One, to make sure that, as Mr. Allen mentioned, that we're not spending additional general fund dollars here, that we've got a self-sustaining program. So the fees are structured in order to just produce enough for one additional staff person to carry on that function. They were also structured in a way to try and not penalize the smaller in-state schools as much, perhaps, as some of the larger schools. I will tell you, though, we're going to take another look as we go through the Ways and Means process of if there is even yet one step fairer way to set those fees, again, with the same goal, just establishing just enough to have that one position, but with the minimal, the most minimal impact possible. So we're working with the career schools to that end.
Okay, so Mr. Chair, the fee sitting here is not the final. It needs to be looked at the Ways and Means.
That's correct.
Okay, that's fine.
Thank you very much. Any further discussion on the Dash 2 amendments? Will the clerk call the roll, please?
Aye.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'll give you a courtesy vote. I want to see that fee thing. I have no problem with the bill. I like it, but I do want to see that fee thing. Yes.
Representative Greenlee. Aye. Representative Cromwell. Aye. Representative Lemley. Aye. Representative Rublin. Aye. Representative Wisnett. Aye. Chair Buckley?
Aye.
The motion carries.
I'd entertain a motion on the bill itself.
Representative Buckley?
Vice Chair Cobb?
I move House Bill 2848 to the Joint Ways, 2845 to the Joint Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Vice Chair Cobb has moved House Bill 2845 to the Joint Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation as amended. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I would prefer that there is not a recommendation, and the primary reason is two things. One is with regards to the fees, I'm not convinced on those yet. I'm also concerned about the fact that raising the fees but then still having kind of a so what in Section 7, I'm not sure gets us there. And I guess I shouldn't make a bigger issue out of the arbitration issue than has already been made, but I guess, you know, we've had one situation in the state. It was a big situation. Quite frankly, I'm very glad that the teacher that blew the whistle, and I'm glad the school's gone. But I'm kind of viewing this as another government overreaction to, you know, you have a situation occurs and it's been taken care of. And I'm kind of trying to figure out, you know, how much of the clause has been used. What's the data on how often the arbitration has been found in favor of the student and how often in favor of the school? And I'm concerned that, you know, are we taking, I think the question that comes up is, are we taking alternative dispute resolution methods away from both parties? So I'm kind of struggling, and that's one of the reasons why I hesitated on the amendments to begin with, and send it to Ways and Means with a recommendation of due pass. I'm having a hard time with that.
Understand that. Thank you, Representative Greenland.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think it needs to have a due pass recommendation if we want it in fact to be passed. It's going to Ways and Means, and it'll be. We'll have no way of looking at it substantively. It's our job to substantively decide on it. And I think if we want to bury it, this is the place to bury it. If we believe it should go to the floor, assuming it passes the financial muster, then I don't think you have any choice but to put a due pass recommendation on it.
Thank you, Representative. And just to note, in committee, there was no testimony against the fee increase by any of the
representatives of the private schools.
Thank you. And concerning the fee increase here, on the first one, 100, the next one, 120 increase, next one, 150, and then it's jumped up 420, and then next 540, things like that. This, I'm not sure what based on the formula. It is not a percentage rate, and it is uneven, and I don't know where it is coming from, but I'm willing to support it. I like the Ways and Means scrutinize of this fee issue, where the basis of this increase.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion? Seeing none, will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Flynn.
Aye.
Representative
Dahl. Well, I'm giving a courtesy vote on the amendment. Feel like I'm going to give a courtesy vote. I like the bill. I like the works. But if the fee schedule changes significantly, I'm going to give you a courtesy vote. And on the floor, Peter, you can beat me up if I vote no for any other reason.
Thank you.
Representative Greenland.
Aye.
Representative
Paul? Aye.
Representative
Cremel?
No.
Representative
Lynn?
Aye.
Representative
Roadland?
Aye.
Representative
Wisnet?
Courtesy, yay, yes, please.
Representative
Buckley? Aye. Motion carries. Representative, I was ill-mannered on the first bill. That was your bill, and I gave it to Representative Clem to carry on the floor. You're fine with that for our colleague here, then thank you for your gracious. Thank you so much for the generous use of your time here before our committee today.
Representative, give my regards, because I don't think I'm going to make it.
I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2845 and open up a work session on House Bill 2579. And Mr. Olson, if you would be so kind as to review what House Bill 2579.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2579 increases the number of directors appointed to the State Board of Higher Education from 1 to 2 members, reapportions the representation of faculty, of public institutions of higher education between these two members. Effectively, members of the committee, it would mandate that one of the positions would be for a member of OSU, Oregon State University, Portland State University, or the University of Oregon, and a second member of the faculty member of the board be from one of the regional universities. Regional is defined as including the Oregon Institute of Technology. This has a minimal fiscal impact, no statement issued, as no subsequent referral.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Members, we do have Mr. Wagner here who helped bring the bill forward. If you have specific questions on the regionals or their desire for representation, Representative Wisnet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I apologize. That's not part of the subcommittee. And I would ask why there was the OSU Cascade campus was not considered one of the regional universities.
Mr. Ray, will you come forward and field that question? Very good question, Representative Wisnet. My apologies for not bringing it up during this up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnet, Rob Wagner with the American Federation of Teachers. It's a great question, actually. It's something that we certainly would be looking forward to maybe taking a look at on the Senate side. We talked to Representative Burley about the bill yesterday. He's as well supportive and raised the same question because I think he hails from a very similar district to yours. I think the intention was, just to give a little bit of background for the folks that weren't on the sub, is that the faculty position on the State Board of Higher Education has always come from the big three campuses, and we've never seen regional representation. So it wasn't an attempt to overlook OSU Cascades. I think that there would certainly consider an amendment on the Senate side. We would appreciate the bill moving forward today, and we'd be glad to work with your office on getting that amendment drafted if it's the desire of the representative from Central Oregon.
Can you enroll Portland and OIT?
Yeah,
no. OSU regional.
I would, Mr. Chair. I think that I would point out that in the Ways and Means process, now that OSU Cascade campus is considered in the regional universities for the budgeting, so it is, in that. I think the OUS system has assumed that they're regional as a university. So that's my only point I would make to justify my request.
Representative Roebuck.
could, the way the bill is structured now, could not the OSU campus select somebody from Cascade and put them on the board for them?
Chair Buckley, Representative Roland, yes.
Okay.
They would still be eligible.
Any additional questions for Mr. Wagner?
Mr. Chair, right, so wait a minute now. I thought we had an agreement we're going to amend it.
And the Senate, Mr. Wagner, said he'd be willing to work with you on the Senate side?
Yeah, because I don't think, to Representative Roland's comment, I don't think that OSU would be willing to give, you know, appoint someone from Cascade Campus to represent them on the Board of Higher Education. I wouldn't expect them to, but they should compete against the other regional universities, I would think, for that one slot.
I wish you could get two, right?
Yeah, I'm for this. Or for that.
Got an ally here in Representative Clem, it looks like, so.
Yeah, Griff.
Any further questions for Mr. Wagner? Thank you, Mr. Wagner, for your time.
Thank you.
Any further discussion on this bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Clem.
I'm sorry to be such a stick in the mud and everything, but. I'm struggling with this, and I think I struggled with it in our subcommittee. When I worked at Western Oregon, I didn't feel any, you know, like I was being slighted because a member of the State Board of Higher Education was from, I believe at the time, was from University of Oregon. But this was 20 years ago, and my memory is fading. I remember a few things, but anyway. And I guess I'm still trying to figure out why we need to do this, and I am concerned, as was shared in the subcommittee by the chancellor and a couple of others, that we start endangering our board's look at issues when we start delineating out this representation group and that representation group and that sort of thing. So I kind of thought about this and I am struggling with it and Mr. Chair, with no with all due respect to the sponsors of the bill, I do have I really don't like it.
That's absolutely fine. So, it's totally interesting.
So I'm going to be a no vote on the bill, and I just thought I should let you know that.
Appreciate that. My only response is, I hate to bring up the rural urban divide on, but again, this is for those of us who live several hundred miles away from the Willamette Valley, we do often feel like our voices are not heard. Sometimes we run for office. Other times we try to change things to guarantee there'll be somewhat a regional voice in the process.
President Dunn, did anyone want to say on this?
No, that was a nonpartisan comment. I'll let yours carry the day.
Thank you very much. Any further discussion on this? Any questions, actually? I'll entertain a motion and still have more discussion on that if you want.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Cobb.
I move House Bill 2579 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Vice Chair Cobb moves House Bill 2579 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion on this bill? Seeing none, can the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Zollum?
Aye.
Representative Mainlick?
Aye.
Representative Cobb?
Aye.
Representative Temple?
No.
Representative Lim?
Aye.
Representative
Goodman? Aye.
Representative
Wisnett? Courtesy, aye, to be sure my university is.
That's another reason.
Should a baseball team there, Ben?
We should have a baseball team. The chair will carry this bill. Can you send these for just a moment?
Do you have any further questions for me?
We're back. back in session. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2579 and open up work session on House Bill 2676, the famous adverse possession bill. Mr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2676 prohibits the application of adverse possession to extinguish or diminish real property interests of school districts or post-secondary institutions, as well as the Oregon School for the Deaf and the Oregon School for the Blind. We discussed this previously in the full committee on March 16th. Since then, we have a dash one amendment that would add education service districts to the list of institutions in the bill whose property adverse possession cannot be applied against. The dash one amendment is in the packet of information in front of you under the agenda. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. This was a bill we did here previously, and again, the amendment adds ESDs to the bill. Are there any questions on this bill?
I'd just like to comment that we use Wikipedia as a index.
That was the first time I think I've seen that. The Wikipedia.
I did have one comment. On this issue, with getting the dash one to date, doesn't trouble me at all. I've been on the original discussion. The rest of you have to fend for yourselves.
Thank you, Representative Dolan.
At that point, I'd entertain a motion.
Representative Buckley.
Vice Chair Kopp.
I move the dash one amendment to House Bill 2676.
Vice Chair Kopp has moved the dash one amendment to House Bill 2676. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion carries. Vice Chair Kopp.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2676 to the floor with a due pass as amended.
Vice Chair Kopp has moved House Bill 2676 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? The due pass as amended. Is there any discussion? Representative Wilson.
This one was going too fast, and so I figured that maybe subsequent referral to the agriculture department. Is this about land?
No.
Rework my school for the blind issue over there, apparently.
It seems interesting suggestion here. Any other discussion? Andy, would you please call the vote?
Representative
Dolan? Aye. Representative Green?
Aye.
Representative
Kamal? Aye. Representative
Lynn?
Aye.
Representative
Grublin?
Aye.
Representative Isnett?
An unconditional yes.
That's good. Representative Kramer, would you be so kind as to school yourself in adverse possession here in this person?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
It seems to me this is
consent calendar.
Consent calendar.
Is there any objection to this being on the consent calendar?
Yes, I object.
All right, Representative Kremel, would you carry this up for us on the floor? Since you object.
He just wants to miss a chance to speak on the floor.
Representative Kremel never speaks on the floor. I'm not sure what you're
talking about.
Thank you, Representative Kremel. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2676 and open up a work session. No, we haven't heard this. I'm going to try to move on here. My apologies to the chair of the House Committee on Health Care. I don't believe we closed the loop to ask you whether this email was sent. I don't think there was
Can you have a little discussion on it?
Yes, we can. So now how do I get this in terms of, I'm not opening for work session on this, I'm going to have another public hearing on this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my understanding from checking with my colleagues in Community Services and with the House clerk is that we just can have a work session to recommend
it's posted. All right.
Right. And we're actually not having public hearings, and no testimony is allowed, or no real discussion of the substance of the bill. And we have. Would you like me, though, to read the staff measure summary and just explain the approval we have?
Sorry, did I open up a work session on this, or are we in a work session?
No, I don't think you did.
I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 3220.
House Bill 3220 directs the school district to issue health report card for each student. It declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2007. As I was mentioning earlier, Mr. Chair, the rationale is the education is holding a work session on House Bill 3220 for the purpose of recommending the referral of the bill to the health care committee. And sending it to the health care committee, the suggestion would be without recommendation as to passage. The committee has requested and received approval from the Speaker's office for this motion. The bill does not currently have the health care committee
recommendation, and my understanding, Mr. Chair, perhaps you'd like to elaborate, is what the thought was this would perhaps a more appropriate bill for the Health Care Committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Representative Crump, I think this is your bill, and the desire to have this for with the Health Care Committee, would you like to elaborate on that a bit?
My recommendation is that the Health Care Committee deals with issues about the person or how to improve individual health and prevention methods, and that is the intent of this bill.
Everybody agree?
Yeah, and I, you know, I'm okay about it, but there are two sets of issues you're going to hear. One is whether these are the right measures to health and whether it makes sense to do this from a health perspective. The other, and I expect to be a major issue, is to hear from the schools about whether they think they can do this sort of thing. So, I mean, there's both sets of issues, the school district issues and the healthcare issues. So I would just suggest if we end up, and I know that because we just got through hearing from the school districts on the nutrition bill, but I suspect we're going to hear real hollering on this one about whether the school districts think they're the appropriate place to create a personal plan for lifestyle on the part of the students. So, I mean, we can hear it over there and send it back here if we have a lot of problem with the schools.
But Representative Cobb is saying it doesn't matter.
if you believe that I support your recommendation, if we might as well start here.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me this isn't a bad place to start. But okay. I'll be glad to take it if that's what you want. And we'll hear it there.
Bill Zerobin.
My comments will be somewhat similar. Having tried to institute a similar, though not as aggressive, program at my high school. There are a lot of issues with respect to schools. This is twice a year. The people who did this in our school were our physical education teachers. They had it for their classrooms, but this is 1,200 kids as opposed to X number of kids that would have to go through it at our school. Every school, twice a year. They have the calibrator, they have the calibers for the fat, body fat, kind of, all that kind of stuff. But then you will also be hearing, I expect, from some parents, because I will tell you that issues that get discussed currently at schools around this, kids get teased for their weight. When you start putting a report card out, it elevates the whole thing again amongst those children. And the other part on bulimia and anorexia, we have a number of parents who get very angry at schools for saying you're too low, and therefore other problems. So I think there are schools.
We can't go too much into content of both things.
Right. Well, that's right.
We're talking about the process of.
So I'm just saying, from my perspective, there will be a lot of comments I would expect from schools with regard to this bill. So where that best is at is.
It can happen either way, and I'll be happy to take it if that's it.
I mean, this is one of those bills that will fill the room. And at the end of the day, yesterday we had a hearing, and my colleague, Representative Wisnott, said, did anybody speak in favor of this bill? And other than the proposers of the bill, Betty, and I think Arnie and I even know the value of what the sponsor is trying to do, but this will fill the room. It will. And they will be, when you talk about somebody else's children and you determining whether they're healthy or not, we'll fill the room. And the room next door, and maybe the room after that. It's a hot issue.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crum.
Again, not trying to necessarily be a wet blanket here. Two questions procedurally. Does the Speaker of the House have the authority to give permission for a bill to bypass having a public hearing in a committee by rule, and also by our committee rules? And do our rules even provide for us to be able to take a bill directly to work session without having had a public hearing on it? I don't want us to get trapped in a situation where we've done something that shouldn't have happened, and all of a sudden procedurally we've got our butt in a swing for not doing something procedurally correct.
Thank you, Rose. I guess assured by
the administration that this was a within the rules to have a work session or to refer the bill. That's why I know we can't discuss the content because we have not a public hearing. Mm-hmm. The process of where the bill should be heard, the lead falls in the rules. And Mr. Olson,
Mr. Chair, Representative Cromwell, I was looking through the rules, having a chance to exhaustively review them. I did speak with Chief Clerk of the House about this. I could call again and clarify. It's, you know, it's perhaps I had a misunderstanding, but my understanding was that we could post as a work session, and the motion would be to recommend without recommendation as to passage, and recommendation of us adding a subsequent referral. But I can always double check to make sure in case I misunderstood what the rules are.
I appreciate it. I think what I'm inclined to do here, and we can discuss further if you'd like to, is we'll go ahead and close the work session without action. Let the Representative Kopp and the Secretary and I talk about this and just figure out where we want to go for it. Other members of the committee want to have an opinion at this point about the desirability of hearing the bill here or there. We are still in that process. Representative Robert?
I was just going to say that we have done this exact same procedure in two other committees. I've also checked with the clerk, so I this is the right procedure to move the bill. We can't move it. The speaker, once it's submitted, cannot move it by themselves. They only can, and it generally comes from the sponsor requesting it to the committee, and at that point, without recommendation, we can move it. That's what I was told to. So I am of the same opinion that that's the proper way to move a bill to a different committee.
Thank you, Mr. Rowan.
Mr. Chair,
without stating whether I like the bill or not, because I don't want to get into it, but I would yield to the desire of the sponsor and the chair and vice chairs in terms of, and the two chairs, in terms of, but I would also say that I would wouldn't object to hearing this bill in our committee. So whatever you all decide, I will yield to, and if you want to vote to move it to the health committee, I would vote to do that. But I think it would be interesting to...
Representative Gollum says you're trying to make up for your no vote.
You know, I got to suck up where I can. Why are you the one turning red?
Yeah. I'd like to... that we move House Bill 42 attorney to the health care committee without recommendation.
Representative Lynn has made a motion to move the House Bill.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. If we do make a motion, it's kind of a lengthy motion because of the nature of it. So if we do want to entertain a motion, I have a suggested script, depending with the chair how wants to proceed.
Do you want to not take action?
I do think, with your indulgence, I would like to close the
okay.
And not take action.
Okay.
And
whatever.
I was about to take the opportunity to have a courtesy no.
On that note,
can I close from the rest of the table?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Mayor. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 220. Thank you for your.
That was a very interesting educational conversation. Committee members.
And if there is nothing else, I believe we are done with our agenda for today. Thank you. Members, this also reminds me that this coming Monday is our last subcommittee meeting for this month. That's at least it's currently scheduled, since we are at the point where we need to move a good number of bills in the next 2 weeks. We'll have the higher ed subcommittee on Monday, and we're going to go into the full education committee from Tuesday on. The schedule is fairly ambitious, and we can get advanced copies of the schedule to you of what bills are coming up. And again, we'll try to get amendments to members prior to hearings every chance we get.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
I misspoke. The subcommittee on innovation does also have hearings next week. So
yes.
It's Monday higher ed, Tuesday innovation, Wednesday higher ed.
Wednesday full.
Yeah, Thursday innovation. Now, I'm confused everybody, and it's Friday, right?
But then, in 2 weeks, does it mean there won't be a subcommittee on higher ed, or there will be a full committee on Monday?
There'll be a full committee on Monday.
So we have full committees Monday, Wednesday, Friday now?
Yes, and then we also will, on the last week of April, we'll take Tuesday and Thursday for full committee as well. We'll get you a schedule as we've worked it out. We do have a schedule that we've made up for the Speaker's office to let them know about what their bills will be seen.
Well, there's some problems with me meeting Tuesday and Thursday with them.
You have conflicts with your other committees?
I have a variety of conflicts, but so we're going to go on a 5-day full committee meeting schedule?
Just for to finish up our bills in the month of April. I'd be glad to sit down with you and go through what the schedule is. Anything else, members? With that, thank you very much for your work today. Have a great weekend, and we are adjourned.
Yes.